Coming up next on Upstate's HealthLink on Air, a sleep specialist tells how to get good quality sleep.
There are a lot of factors involved in maintaining a good sleep habit. Probably the most important is to maintain the regular sleep hours.
A childhood cancer survivor from Casanova shares the children's books she's written about cancer.
Every cell in your body has a job to do, just like every ant in a colony has a job to do. And when some ants don't do their job, the whole colony kind of suffers.
And a child and adolescent psychiatrist explains how a new training program is meant to help solve the child mental health crisis.
It's a year-long commitment to really diving in and working with this underserved community.
All that and a visit from the Healing Muse, coming up after the news. This is Upstate Medical University's HealthLink on Air, your chance to explore health, science, and medicine with the experts from Central New York's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Amber Smith. On this week's show, a childhood cancer survivor shares the children's book she's written about cancer and set in her hometown of Casanova. Then we'll hear about a new training program for child and adolescent mental health providers. But first, a pulmonologist talks about sleep disorders and what you can do to improve the quality of your sleep. From Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, I'm Amber Smith. This is HealthLink on Air. How is sleep tied to our mental health? What can improve our ability to focus during the day? How can fatigue weigh a person down physically, mentally, and emotionally? I'll talk about all of this with Dr. Dragos Manta. He's a doctor who specializes in sleep medicine at Upstate. Welcome to HealthLink on Air, Dr. Manta.
Thank you for having me, Amber.
I'd like to start by asking you about the impact the pandemic has had on sleep disorders overall. Have you seen more people with trouble sleeping over the past couple of years?
Yes, unfortunately, the pandemic has been a major problem for the sleep community. At the beginning was definitely very disrupting for, you know, the care of our sleep patients. So I remember we had to go through a lot of changes and we could not see patients. We had to switch to telemedicine. The sleep lab had to be closed. And then, although initially it sounded like with the close downs, we had more time to sleep, you know, that was just a transient issue. And over time, we have been seeing a lot of insomnia, a lot of people having trouble sleeping because of the stressors that were associated with this pandemic, having to do with, you know, health stressors and economic stressors. So it has been definitely a high increase of insomnia cases during the pandemic and has definitely worsened the sleep of our general population.
So if the sleep disturbances are tied to stressors, economic or the fears of COVID and that sort of thing, is there a risk that those disorders would become chronic or will they resolve when the stress resolves?
In some patients, definitely a stressor can cause long-term consequences. A significant stressor can be a precursor or a risk factor for chronic insomnia. Not in everybody. A lot of people can recover from stressor, but some people will develop chronic insomnia after a significant stressor. We see a lot in patients that undergo, you know, major accidents, for example, or major health issues that chronically can have problems. So yes, it could be a problem in a certain subset of patients.
Well, let's talk about how the quality of sleep helps maintain mental health. What happens in our bodies while we sleep, and what physical impact does that have on our mental state?
Well, a lot happens during sleep. I think we know a lot about it, but there is a lot that we don't know. But in general, we all know that sleep is essential. There is no way we can survive without sleep. Sleep is restorative for, you know, your brain and your body. So it's imperative to have a certain amount of sleep every night. And people that are sleep deprived have significant, you know, long-term consequences, both medical and then psychological.
So definitely, I think people feel a difference if they've had a good night's sleep. You know, they tend to wake up feeling better than if they've had a bad night's sleep. What happens physically and mentally and emotionally when we're fatigued? Are we more likely to make mistakes?
Yeah, I mean, definitely there are numerous health consequences of poor sleep quality or sleep deprivation. Definitely your performance will be decreased. Definitely you are going to be at higher risk of, accidents, for example. That the one that comes to mind right away is increased risk of motor vehicle accidents. When there are long-term medical consequences, sleep deprivation and insomnia are associated with increased cardiovascular risk on the long term. There is an increased risk of dementia with sleep deprivation, as well as an increased risk of cancer. Non-restorative sleep or sleep deprivation have a lot of short-term and long-term consequences.
I'd like to ask you, as a sleep expert, what you think of daylight saving time and how the body reacts to dark mornings versus dark nights.
The sleep community for a while has been advocating against the daylight savings time, because the forced change in the sleep habits twice a year have a lot of consequences, especially during the spring time. There is an increased risk of sleep deprivation, increased risk of, motor vehicle accidents, and even increased cardiovascular risk, including risk of heart attacks in the week following the fall bath time. The sleep community has been advocated for permanent universal time rather than switching to daylight saving time every year.
So our body will just adapt to the natural fluctuations in sunrise and sunset times without noticing?
That's correct, because the light is the biggest, contributor to your circadian rhythm or your sleep rhythm. So your body will just follow the natural, light cycle.
Well, I'd like to ask you about the advice you give patients to get quality sleep. What can a person do if they have trouble falling asleep? When they, get into bed and lay down, they just can't go to sleep.
So there are a lot of factors involved in maintaining a good sleep habit. Probably the most important is to maintain the regular sleep hours. So keeping the same bedtime and waking up time every day. There are two processes that tend to maintain our sleep cycle. One of them is the homeostatic process. So you are sleepier and sleepier the more you're awake, but also there is a innate circadian rhythm. So we all have a certain higher propensity of falling asleep during the night and less chance of falling asleep during the day. So aligning those two processes generates the best sleep. So keeping the same hours is probably the most important. The second one is probably getting enough light exposure during the day, especially during the morning. The light is the one that maintains that circadian rhythm, and getting enough exposure to light during the day, it's very important. And not getting too much exposure to light during the night, which is a common thing that happens, with, too much light exposure at night, watching TV, staying on the computer all night. So those are probably the most important things. There are a lot of other things, like making sure you get, exercise every day. Caffeine is also a big problem. So not having, caffeine late in the afternoon, it's important.
Is there anything special someone should do if they go to sleep okay, but then they have a tendency to wake up in the middle of the night and then they can't get back to sleep?
We see this in patients with insomnia, and what we recommend is if you wake up and you really cannot fall back asleep within a reasonable amount of time, which for most patients, it's probably 15, 20 minutes, we recommend getting out of bed and ideally even going out of the bedroom and doing something in low light until you become sleepy again, and return to your bed, in your bedroom only when you are sleepy and ready to go back to sleep.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air with your host, Amber Smith. I'm talking with Dr. Dragos Manta. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Upstate, and one of his specialty areas is sleep medicine. Do you ever recommend any sleep medications?
We've been looking a lot into this because over the years, there have been a lot of medications that have been approved and tried for sleep. And just the fact that we've had so many different medications tells you that they don't really work very good. The American Academy of Sleep Medicine and also the American College of Physicians, they really recommend that medication should be a second line treatment. And the first line treatment, it's a combination of what we call cognitive and behavioral therapy, where you work with your provider to identify the problems that cause your sleep problems on the long term and develop better sleep habits in the first place. And sometimes patients need to see a psychologist to help with that before resorting to medication. So medications are really a second line treatment. And, you know, the current recommendation is to be used just short term because there are a lot of long term consequences associated with, especially with hypnotics.
How can we determine how much sleep we really need? Because I know some people who exist on few hours and some people who really require a lot of hours.
Yeah, so there is a certain variability in the sleep duration of populations. Most of the people need anywhere between 7 and 8 hours of sleep. There are people that need that can get away with 6 hours, and there are individuals that need 9 hours of sleep. So between 6 and 9 hours, it's probably normal, as long as otherwise, you know, you are doing okay. Most of the people should know how much it's genetically determined. So, you know, most of the people know how much time you need to sleep by your early adult years. You know, teenagers do need a little bit more sleep. So, you know, I wouldn't go on based on how much sleep you need as a teenager, but I usually ask my patients, by your mid-20s, what is total hour of sleep that you need? That's kind of my guiding principle. Okay, is this patient needing less than that? And there, you know, if sleeps less than that, then there might be a problem. If that's how much they need, there are people that are short sleepers, there are people that are long sleepers. And as long as they function okay, then that's not necessarily abnormal.
Does it matter when those hours take place within a 24-hour period? Can you sleep anytime and get good quality sleep?
Well, you can sleep anytime if you are very, very tired, but generally you should try to align those hours to that circadian rhythm. And most of the people, they are, you know, sleepier during the night, but there are people that work the night shift and they train their circadian rhythm to be more sleepy during the day by constant exposure to light at night and sleeping during the day. So as long as you sleep during your determined circadian rhythm, those are the best hours to sleep. And some people do get a little benefit from a nap in the afternoon because there is a certain dip in the circadian, in the alertness during the afternoon. That's also natural. Some patients in some cultures that observe the siesta, they get a benefit from a nap in the mid-afternoon hours.
Now, what about someone who's really, really busy during the week? Can they plan to catch up on their sleep on the weekends?
It's better than not to catch up. Ideally, you should have the same type of the same sleep hours every day. But, you know, if you are sleep deprived, it's okay to catch up. I would say make sure you catch up during the same, you know, time period that you usually sleep during the weekdays. Maybe go to sleep a little earlier or add another hour. I would not add a lot of sleep time because that can change your circadian rhythm.
Well, I imagine everyone may have trouble sleeping on occasion, but I wonder how much of the population has a real disorder like insomnia or sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome. Do you have an idea how common sleep disorders are?
They're very common. So insomnia and sleep apnea are probably the most common, you know, sleep disorders. The estimations vary, but depending on the population that you look at, they vary anywhere between 5% and 15-20% of the population might have what is called chronic insomnia. And also there is a high incidence of sleep apnea, again, with incidences between 5 and 20%, depending on what patient population you look at. But yeah, unfortunately, sleep problems are very common.
So how long should a person struggle with sleep issues before they consult, a specialist?
In general, short-term insomnia, it's related to a stressor and tends to get better after the stressor disappears. But if patients have problems falling asleep at least 3 times a week for 3 months, then we call that a chronic insomnia disorder. And for that, I would recommend to see somebody because it can become a long-term condition.
So if someone comes to see a sleep specialist like yourself, you may recommend a sleep study. Can you walk us through what that is and what a person should expect?
Not everybody needs a sleep study, but a lot of patients do. I would say insomnia by itself, most of the time it's a clinical diagnosis and you do not need a sleep study. We would recommend a sleep study for somebody that we worry about sleep apnea, which is a condition where the breathing is impaired during sleep or other abnormal behaviors during sleep, like sleepwalking, sleep talking, or acting out your dreams. So in situations like that, we would recommend a sleep study, which basically it's a recording of your sleep, looking at several parameters, looking at your brain waves, looking at your breathing, your muscle tone, and other EKG oxygen saturations. Most of the patients come to the sleep lab and they get pretty much a room, almost like a hotel room where the technologists would apply all these leads and sensors. Believe it or not, patients still fall asleep despite of all that. And then we record what happens during sleep. And then we send the patients home in the morning. We review the data. And then we try to make a diagnosis of what is causing the patient's sleep problem.
Do you think if someone's partner is snoring at night that they need to see a sleep specialist?
I mean, snoring is very, very common. Not everybody who snores needs to see a sleep doctor. I would say if a bed partner would observe breathing problem during sleep, what you call apnea or an episode of stopping breathing during sleep or choking during sleep, that happens more than occasionally, that would be a reason to maybe consider seeing a sleep doctor. If somebody who snores very loudly is also very sleepy, that's also an indication that somebody might be at risk of having sleep apnea. So I would say not everybody that snores. I'd say snoring with some other signs that there might be something going on more than just snoring.
I know that there's a lot of people that rely on sleep apnea machines when they're sleeping. I wonder are there alternatives to sleep apnea machines? Because I think a lot of people look at the contraption and the tubes and they're just like, there's no way I can sleep with that.
I would say that, yes, there are alternatives. But the CPAP machine, despite of all the contraptions, is still the best treatment for sleep apnea. And I have to tell you that I've been taking care of so many patients that came to me and they said, no, I don't think I can use that. You would be surprised how many patients that initially wouldn't even consider it. You know, they feel so much better and I swear by it. So it's definitely something that initially sounds like looks, you know, a little bit more difficult, but it is the gold standard of treatment. And I would be very reluctant to go to a second line because all the other lines of treatment are really, I wouldn't even call them second line, I would say maybe third or fourth line of treatments. But yes, you are right. Some patients after that trial, a lot of patients feel better, but some patients cannot tolerate. And in that situation, we do have other options. The most popular one would be an oral appliance, which is a device that a dentist will make that, you know, the patients will have to sleep with at night. It's effective, although a little less effective and mostly effective in maybe mild to moderate cases of sleep apnea.
You called it a CPAP machine. What does that stand for?
It stands for continuous positive airway pressure. So it's a device that maintains a certain pressure into the airway to prevent the airway collapse. That is the main problem that happens with sleep apnea.
Well, I really appreciate you making time for this interview, Dr. Manta.
You're welcome. I'm glad. I hope this helps.
My guest has been Dr. Dragos Manta. He's an assistant professor of medicine at Upstate who specializes in sleep medicine. I'm Amber Smith for Upstate's HealthLink on Air. A children's book about cancer written by a childhood cancer survivor. Next on Upstate's HealthLink on Air. From Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, I'm Amber Smith. This is HealthLink on Air. Adults may find it difficult to talk to children about complex circumstances such as a friend's cancer diagnosis. Today, I'm speaking with Dr. Anne Bramlage. She's a native of Cazenovia and the author of a children's book that may help. It's called Lakeside Friends, A Story About Cancer. Welcome to HealthLink on Air, Dr. Bramlage.
Thank you, Amber, for having me. It's great to be here.
Now, your book takes place in a village with a lake. Were you inspired by your hometown of Casanova?
Yes, I was. I grew up in Casanova. At the age of 4, my parents moved to Cas, and there I attended elementary, middle, and high school, and then actually went off to college. And then later in life, I moved back for a few years. So Casanova has always been my hometown, and I still have family and many friends there.
Were you always interested in becoming a writer when you were growing up? Is that something that you aspired to do?
It's funny. I enjoyed writing, but I never thought it would be anything of importance or anything surmountable. I majored in elementary education and then became a teacher. And then later on went back to get my doctorate. So education and reading has always been a fundamental key important aspect for me. And so now becoming a writer, I've really been able to embrace how I can further educate children.
What grade do you teach?
I was an elementary school teacher. So I taught in grades kindergarten and then second grade for a little bit and then third grade. And then my last position was in more in middle school, kind of like a fifth and sixth grade.
Interesting. Well, let's talk about this book. Can you give us a synopsis of the story?
Sure thing. Brooke invites Joel to come to the lake. And Joel can't go to the lake because he has cancer. And so Brooke learns through a real life analogy, I use an ant colony to kind of educate Brooke about what cancer is. And at the end of the book, Brooke gives a gift to Joel as a way of encouraging him as he goes through his journey.
And these children are elementary age children.
Yes, the book is for ages 3 to about 7. But I've also had many young children read it, 10, 11, 12-year-olds read it. In fact, one of my close friends bought it for his son, and he sent me an email saying, "Ann, your book is great. Thank you. My 11-year-old now understands cancer." And to my knowledge, they did not have any, there was no cancer diagnosis in their family at all. It just, his son now understands what cancer is.
Well, tell me a little bit more about how the ant colony helps describe cancer for children.
Yes, the ant colony, I wanted to really create a picture or an image or a way for children to understand what cancer was, because it's really, it's a complex thing, and there's many different types of cancers and different treatments and everything like that. So I use a simple ant colony to really describe the fundamental of what cancer is. And cancer is uncontrolled cell growth, and every cell in your body has a job to do, just like every ant in a colony has a job to do. And when some ants don't do their job, the whole colony kind of suffers. In the same way, when some out of control cells don't really do their job within the body kind of suffers.
Now, your name is Ann Bramlage. How did you decide on using AB Namey as a pen name?
So AB Namey, I kind of took the first initial of Ann Bramlage and put it as AB, and then Namey is my maiden name. And so having the books come from my hometown, it just kind of made the best sense to kind of use a pen name of my maiden name.
Well, I understand that you survived childhood cancer. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, absolutely. At the age of 6, I was diagnosed with non-osseous Ewing sarcoma, which in easy terms just simply means cancer not in the bone. So it was in the tissue located under my right arm. And for about a year, my whole first grade year, actually, I was not in school. I received treatments, chemotherapy and radiation. And from then on, during that time, I lost my hair. I had a tutor that whole year. I did not go to school. So it was a challenging time, but I got through it. My parents were very supportive, and so were my friends.
I was going to ask what you remember about the reaction of your friends, particularly.
My friends that I knew were understanding. two stories come to mind here when you asked me that question. The first one is after each treatment, and there were one treatment per month, just about. So after a treatment, my dad would take me and whatever friend that I kind of chose at the time to kind of hang out with. So each month it could be a different friend. And we went to the mall. And so it was an evening where after my treatment, sometime after when I'm, you know, feeling better, I invited a friend to go to the mall. It was a time out, and my friends were able to ask questions. We were able to hang out and do real life things together. Because I had missed so much of first grade, my parents didn't want me to lose relationships with friends. So we went to the mall. It was a great time. And that was just one time that I really remember being able to share with my friends, to have my dad around. Sometimes my mom would take me. It didn't matter. Either one. And then on the flip side, I have a different story that is, it's not so great, but you know, it is what it is. One time I was heading to the bus, and this was kind of when I returned back to school, but my hair hadn't really grown in yet. So it was the end of the day. I was heading to the bus, and at the bus or somewhere on the way to the bus, there was this little boy that would always pick on me. And as a kid, I would wear baseball caps because I didn't have any hair and I just didn't want to go around bald, and I really didn't want to wear a wig at that age. So I wore a baseball cap. And he would always tease me that I didn't have hair. And so one of the teachers, one of the monitors there, saw this little boy picking on me. And, you know, from then on, I had a teacher escort me to my bus every day after school. But at the same time, I wonder what that little boy, if he would have treated me differently, if he understood what I went through and why I didn't have any hair. And maybe a resource like my book could have really benefited him in terms of what he could understand about it.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air with your host, Amber Smith. I'm talking with author Anne Bromledge. She's written a children's book called Lakeside Friends, A Story About Cancer. Can you explain the process of creating this book? Did you have the complete story in your head before you started writing?
I did not. So one of my friends asked me, her mother recently was diagnosed with breast cancer, and she had some young children elementary school age, and she knew my background and everything like that, and asked me, Ian, how am I going to tell my kids that their grandmother has cancer? And I said, well, I don't know. That's a really great question. Best of luck type of thing. And I really got to thinking after that. So I did a little digging myself, and I read some books, some children's books about it. The books that I read that are out there were all geared towards children who have cancer, you know, really going to see the doctor, what's going on in their body, really explaining cancer to them. So my book is unique in a way that it explains cancer to their friends, their siblings. Maybe it explains cancer to a family whose grandmother just learned that she had cancer. So that's where the idea came from. And using a real life analogy is something that I was able to bring into the book where kids would understand it who are not going through treatments. Not to say that this book is not for kids who are undergoing treatments as well. It is for both. But it really is a resource for parents to use, for siblings, for friends, for teachers to read in a classroom of maybe where they have a student who was diagnosed with cancer.
How closely did you work with the artist? Because it's got really nice drawings all through the book.
Thank you very much. I really worked with the artist. I wanted to show images of Casanova. I wanted to show images of that small town. And I really worked to create character development so that in more books going forward, I can show, you know, the same characters again. I just went back and forth with him a lot to get the images that I wanted. So I really appreciate that you collect the images.
As a survivor yourself of childhood cancer, what would you say to a child who's just been diagnosed?
I would say that they can do it, that they can beat cancer. It might be tough. It will be tough, but they can do it. And this time will pass, and they can beat cancer. And cancer is beatable, and they can go back to having their normal life back of being a kid and seeing their friends again. And this cancer that has happened in their life won't slow them down.
What would you say to that child's friends?
I would tell them what's going on, that their friend has some cells that just aren't doing the right job, that they're out of control, that they're growing uncontrolled in their body, and they're just not doing their job. And the best way to be a friend is to encourage, to support, and do the best that they can in helping their friend out.
You talked about your parents making sure that you maintain connections and friendships and going to the mall regularly when you were able to. When, as an adult, you look back at what you went through as a child, is there anything you would have liked to change?
The one thing that really stands out to me is there wasn't, I was 6 years old, and my siblings were 4 and 1. So I had 2 younger brothers at the time. So they didn't ask too many questions. The one thing, though, that I noticed looking back now is that there wasn't a ton of resources. And maybe there were more resources for my parents, and they just, you know, didn't really go on to share that so much with me. But there weren't books, there weren't podcasts, there wasn't as much awareness or even discussion about it. I remember just going to the doctor and learning more about what was going on in my body from the doctors. There weren't TV shows, there weren't books, like I said. So that's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this, was to bring awareness, to bring knowledge, to bring understanding to people, to children.
My guest has been Anne Bromlage, author of Lakeside Friends, A Story About Cancer. I appreciate you making time for this interview, Dr. Bromlage.
Thank you, Amber. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Amber Smith for Upstate's HealthLink on Air. Next on Upstate's HealthLink on Air, one way psychiatrists are helping to solve the child mental health crisis. From Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York, I'm Amber Smith. This is HealthLink on Air. Children's mental health services are in crisis, with an acute shortage of psychiatrists, psychologists, counselors, and social workers everywhere, not just in Central New York. I'm talking about what's being done to help with child and adolescent psychiatrist Nayla Corey. She's an assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at Upstate. Welcome to HealthLink on Air, Dr. Corey.
Thank you so much.
Why is there a shortage of mental health providers? Because I understand this was an issue before the pandemic, right?
Yeah, that's right. It's always been an issue nationally and globally as well. And, you know, I think, frankly, the need just has outweighed the supply of mental health providers for a very long time. Mental health disorders such as anxiety and depression are very common. And we know that in the last 2 years, globally, there's estimates of doubling of disorders such as that in this pandemic of loneliness. So now more so than ever, the shortage is being felt, which is why we're in crisis, as you mentioned.
Now, what attracted you to child and adolescent psychiatry to begin with when you got into this profession?
I think as a first-generation immigrant to the U.S. whose parents came from war-torn Lebanon, I've always been interested in global health and trauma. I found a calling for psychiatry and child psychiatry because of the focus on prevention, working with families, being able to support resilience, and really try to alter the course for a young kiddo who may be struggling with all sorts of issues. But it kind of came first from my own experiences, and then the joy of being able to work with whole people, hear their stories and families.
It sounds like it would be immensely rewarding as a career. So I'm wondering what factors you think are preventing people from going into this field.
Yeah, that's a really good question, because I do think that most psychiatrists even would enjoy the extra training. We think of ourselves as whole life psychiatrists, those of us who've done the additional training. I think, frankly, it's the overwhelming medical school debt that prevents and prohibits a lot of people from taking on an additional 2 years when they could be instead making a salary that is much more than training.
Sure. Well, now I understand Upstate is part of a collaborative training program with Syracuse University. What can you tell us about this program and what's its mission?
Yeah, this is an exciting partnership with Syracuse University to help meet the needs and to provide behavioral health experiential training opportunities. So there's a couple of goals for this program. One is to diversify the number of mental health providers and to have them have more experiences in underserved settings with multidisciplinary team approaches. The focus is on the city of Syracuse, as well as Onondaga Nation, which we know have a need for mental health providers, and working collaboratively to provide interdisciplinary training for both the trainees and the supervisors on site. So it's very, very exciting, and I think ultimately will help improve the quality of diverse mental health providers in underserved areas that may not otherwise get to have as much access to care.
So if I understand what you're saying, I mean, there'll be sort of a commitment to providing training for people so that they can get the training they need and get into practice.
Yeah, that's correct. The target is for students who are completing master's level social work or psychology postdoctorate students. So they're already in training, but it's providing them more enriched experiences earlier on. And at least in the case of the work with the Onondaga Nation Behavioral Health Collaborative, it's a year-long commitment to really diving in and working with this underserved community.
Well, let's talk about the role and specialization of the various professions in the field of mental health. I know that psychiatrists are the medical doctors, the MDs, who can prescribe medication. How do the psychiatrists differ from psychologists?
People often get us confused. So psychiatrists, like you said, have gone through 4 years of medical school and then 4 years of residency. And then in the case of child and adolescent psychiatry, 2 more years of training. Whereas psychologists are most often PhDs who have had extensive training in theory and therapies and testing, psychological testing as well. And then there's other mental health providers too, which I'm sure you'll be curious about. And I often have to look it up. I think it's very confusing to sort through both the training, the lens. But this is actually one of the benefits of our program. And one of the reasons I enjoy the collaborative training is that I do think we all bring different experiences and lenses to the work.
Right. You mentioned social workers. I mean, I can think of school counselors. And you're right. People in those roles have a varied background. So, you know, one social worker isn't the same as another social worker.
Right. Right. One of the unique lenses that social work brings is a focus on systems as well. So systems of oppression and social justice, as well as clinical practice. So that's something I like to learn from the social workers that I work with.
Now, your biography lists cross-cultural psychiatry among your interests. What is that?
Oh, yeah, I'm happy to share about that. I first got into and learned about cross-cultural psychiatry in medical school when I had some time studying and working in Haiti. So it was first sort of learning about how mental illness can be identified, expressed, and treated in other cultures. And I think over time, I've come to learn and see how cross-cultural psychiatry also just applies to understanding the culture of medicine and how we interface with different families and cultures, even here in the U.S. and in Syracuse. So even, for example, our DSM-5, which carries the diagnoses that we use to diagnose and guide treatment as medical professionals, is culturally contextualized. And even though I think globally people use the DSM-5, there's also other classifications used elsewhere and a growing recognition that depression here may look a little bit different than depression somewhere else. And just a very interesting interplay and conflict around how do we make sure people learn about the DSM diagnosis, but also be respectful and humble about how our disorders may not present exactly the same elsewhere. And there may be other treatments that are really useful in different communities.
Do you find, are there some cultures where depression is taboo and you can't really call it that?
Oh, absolutely. I think in many communities, mental health disorders that are less severe or are not psychotic in nature are frankly invisible. So depression and anxiety isn't seen at all. And so patients will be much more likely to present with a heavy heart or a head that's full than with our typical depression checklist that we talk about in the DSM-5. And there's also just interesting thoughts to consider how consciously or unconsciously people learn what's culturally acceptable ways of expressing distress. Depression is a really good example of that. So whereas we might be able to see someone looks depressed because they are shut down, they're not eating, they're not engaging in life. And I do think depression exists globally, no matter where you are. People may not come in saying, I feel guilty, I have low self-esteem. In cultures that are much more communal, the focus might be on how I'm not able to support my family or function in that capacity. So it can look a little bit different.
This is Upstate's HealthLink on Air with your host, Amber Smith. I'm talking with Dr. Nayla Corey. She's a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Upstate. We've talked about the different cultures. Do you see a difference in patients from different socioeconomic status, people that have wealth versus people who are poor?
Well, yes and no. I mean, mental illness affects people across socioeconomic status, and yet there's much added challenges for families coming from lower SES. For one, they may have less access to care, to even showing up to treatment, partly because of insurance, partly because of being able to make an appointment during regular business hours, transportation, et cetera. And then when they're able to get into the door to see us, frankly, folks with lower SES are just more likely to have many other structural determinants of health, many other factors going on that put them at increased risk for trauma-related disorders or intergenerational trauma. So it becomes even more important to be aware of how to support the whole family in seeking resilience, that it's not just about the kid coming in as the identified patient, but how do we support the whole family as best we can, the parents, the grandparents, the extended family. So yeah, it is an important factor both for access and for treatment.
We hear about the importance of preventive care, mostly like with health screenings and medical checkups and things like that. Are there ways to proactively identify mental health problems in an individual before they become a crisis?
Absolutely. So one of the other hats I wear is as a child and adolescent psychiatrist working with Project Teach, where we train and work collaboratively with primary care physicians. So there are rating scales that can be used to help identify those at greater risk, such as scales looking for depression and anxiety. But in general, I think some of the things that are important to keep in mind is observing people's behavior and noticing changes over time. So if somebody is normally very bubbly and extroverted and is all of a sudden shut down and not speaking, that's a red flag. Or vice versa. If someone, especially when we think about young people, the areas of function to pay attention to, if a kid isn't going to school, that's a huge red flag. They may already be in crisis. If they're all of a sudden plummeting in terms of academic performance or doing much differently than they did before, that's something to inquire more about. If they're unable to enjoy time with friends, if they're isolating more, these are some signs that we may need to evaluate more what's going on.
How does a parent know if they suspect that their child needs professional help? How does a parent know which therapist, psychiatrist, social worker, psychologist, how do they decide which person or profession would be the most help for their child?
It's a really good question. And I don't think it's a parent's role to know that necessarily. I think first and foremost, sort of seeking out the supports that exist for that parent. So going to the primary care physician or pediatrician or family doctor and asking for help. And that person can be one person to help guide where to go next, or within the school system, touching base with the school counselor or psychologist, asking for more testing if needed or more support. And these professionals can help guide what's needed from there. So there's sort of a tiered approach. Most kids won't need to see a child and adolescent psychiatrist. We're kind of for the most severe kiddos, but there's a lot of steps in between. And I don't think it's really about the professional so much as it is about the connection between the kid and the therapist. The other piece is it also depends on what kind of therapy the kid needs and what type of training the therapist has had. And so some of that takes assessment before you can know entirely.
Do you have advice for how to choose a therapist, or do they match up a child's characteristics with a therapist's characteristics to find a relationship that's going to work?
Yes and no. I mean, there's an increase focus and attention to sort of telemedicine and telehealth. And even here within Upstate, we're looking to figure out if we should purchase as a hospital system telehealth options to increase access for everybody. And in some of those systems, they do more matching, like you said. Frankly, most systems don't have the luxury to be able to match as well as we'd like to. We often cannot match based on gender. It's an overwhelmingly female field, or race or ethnicity. And so the choices are often limited. One of the goals and missions of this grant is to increase diversity in the workforce. So there is a focus and intention to picking trainees that look more like the community in different ways. And I do think that's important. The advice I would give to a young person in a family too is to give it time to that you don't really know until you start meeting with somebody if it's going to work. And then it takes a little bit of time before, I would say give at least 3 sessions before you may make a decision about whether to proceed or not, because relationships take time. And even though a kid might go into a relationship thinking, I want somebody who looks exactly like this or meets this criteria, it may not be, in fact, what they need for therapy, for healing. So it's both the practical that we can't always match, and I think really can be very beneficial to know that we can be healed by all sorts of different types of people with different backgrounds.
What should a person do if they aren't clicking with their therapist? Yeah. And especially now when there's such a shortage, in one sense, shouldn't a person be grateful that they have a therapist? Because they are hard to come by right now.
I think it depends. On the one hand, making sure that the patient and family have given it enough time. I also encourage all families that I talk to where there's a question of fit to let the therapist know and give direct feedback about what's not working. Because in fact, some of the most important therapeutic work happens when we repair a misrepair. Where the kid is able to say, when you said that the other day, I felt judged. And the therapist apologizes and says, I didn't mean that. And now I know. And so that gives the therapist an opportunity to grow and the child an opportunity to speak up for themselves. So not easy to do. Most often people would like to just switch and avoid the discussion, but that discussion is very important to have. On the other hand, it's so important that a kiddo and anybody feels safe and that they have choice. And so having choice is also the choice to say this isn't working and to switch providers. So it's a both and. I always encourage kids to talk to their therapist and then say if it's not working, you can always switch or try to switch.
My guest has been Dr. Nayla Khoury, a child and adolescent psychiatrist at Upstate. Thank you for making time for this interview, Dr. Khoury.
Thanks so much for having me today.
I'm Amber Smith for Upstate's HealthLink on Air. And now, Deirdre Nealon, editor of Upstate Medical University's literary and visual arts journal, The Healing Muse, with this week's selection.
Boston poet Kasia Martin Gauthier talks about social distancing and what it suggests about human nature as we tried to follow the early guidance we were given. Her poem, How I've Survived This Long, Part 3, begins with an epigram. CDC tip, hold your arms out toward the person next to you. Your 3-foot arm plus theirs will equal the recommended distance. Of course, it is strange to inhabit this earth only connected by the air we breathe. If we all spread out across the world's land masses, our fingertips touching, we'd make a giant corporeal net, a grid of electric human energy upon which anything might be communicated. A virus replicates, desires its host come in contact with another host. Honestly, I desire the same. What am I, if not a host for touch? I'm unaware of what I carry within me. With my touch, I convey consequence beyond what I intend. 14 days later, a death on the other side of the world, and I'm unable to trace back along the web I created, unable to trace myself back to the source.
This has been Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Next week on HealthLink on Air, an important overview about kidney health. If you missed any of today's show, or for more information on a variety of health, science, and medical topics, visit our website at healthlinkonair.org. Upstate's HealthLink on Air is produced by Jim Howe, with sound engineering by Stephen Shaw. This is your host, Amber Smith, thanking you for listening.